It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look at the highlights from the past 2.5 days of hearings for Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson. First, for a good idea to take root, grow, and have a big impact, it needs more than luck. It needs to be able to scale, to be used in a wide variety of situations and circumstances. Our guest says that's easier said than done, but there are lots of strategies to use and mistakes to avoid to make sure that our great concept, our solution to a problem, makes it from a small platform to a bigger one to maybe a world-changing one. And he says with the careful use of data, we can make a big difference in a business, in a community, even around the world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever tried to start a business or grow a business or maybe a community event or a public service? What have you encountered as you tried to scale it up? What kind of successes? What kind of problems did you run into? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Wisconsin's own John A. List is the Kenneth C. Griffin Distinguished Service Professor in Economics at the University of Chicago. He's a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. John received his bachelor's degree from UW-Stevens Point. His new book is called The Voltage Effect, How to Make Good Ideas Great and Great Ideas Scale. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
That concept of scale, so important to your book. Can you give us a little more of a definition of what we mean when we talk about scaling our ideas?
No, absolutely. So I want you to start by thinking about a petri dish or an initial experiment or exploration in a city. And if you find something great in that initial study, scaling is about, can it survive growth and go to other cities or other towns or other communities and have the exact same level of impact?
And the voltage effect, that's what you use to kind of define, like, does it keep up that energy? Does it keep up that success in that initial round in the petri dish or the school or the business, whatever it might be? What do we mean by voltage?
Exactly. So some of the listeners might be confused, but I want you to think about voltage as a simple question. Does what happens in the small also happen in the large? So if you have a great, great effect or big impact in the small, should you expect that to happen also in the large? And I'm here to tell you that it won't. There will be a voltage effect. Now, whether it's a voltage drop or a voltage gain depends on the features of your idea.
You give lots of specific examples from your own work with businesses, governments, schools, and more. I want to tackle one of them. You worked with the car company Chrysler when they were having a tough time for a while on an employee health program aimed at saving money at the company. An initially promising result. Can you talk us through that story?
Sure. That's a great story to start with. So the CEO was named Tom Lasorda, and I don't want you to think about the baseball manager from the LA Dodgers, Tom. That was not a typo, Rob. A real guy named Tom Lasorda. He's from Germany, and he had a handlebar mustache, and he and the exec team flew down to the University of Chicago to talk to me and some colleagues. And they wanted to talk to us about problems that they had at Chrysler. And one of the problems that Tom pointed out was he felt they had an overweight or an obesity problem amongst their line workers. And he thought that that obesity problem led to absenteeism and presenteeism. So some of you may never have heard of presenteeism. What that means is you're actually physically on the job, but you're not very productive. So what we did is we put together a weight loss program that we tried in Dearborn, in the Dearborn manufacturing plant, and it looked great. And the initial results showed that within 6 months, we had a lot of these line employees, a lot of these manufacturing employees losing weight. So Tom said, let's scale it to all of the plants immediately. And we said, whoa. Let's take another look and let's try it again. Let's try to replicate it, not only in the Dearborn plant, but let's try it in two new plants. And what we found is a big no result, no result, and no result in all three of those plants. And what that told us is the initial insight was just a false positive. It was like when you take a COVID test and it says you're COVID positive, but you're actually negative. And that's what these results showed us. So we went back to the lab and produced something that actually did have voltage for him.
That illustrates one of what you describe as five pratfalls, five mistakes that people run across when they scale it up. Could you talk about the more general case here of that initial promising result that maybe was just a fluke?
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. So the story that I lead off the book with is actually Nancy Reagan and the DARE program. And in the DARE program, I was sitting in Sun Prairie High School. So that's where I went to high school. And a DARE program representative came in. And for all of you who don't remember or don't know what DARE is, it was a program where people would come in and say, just say no to drugs. And it was a social inoculation program. It was an information program. So these officials came in and they told us all about the bad reasons for, you know, why we shouldn't use drugs, et cetera, et cetera. So I looked at my teacher and I said, look, I don't use drugs, but I have a lot of friends who do. And there's no way this is going to work. In fact, if anything, Rob, I told him, it's going to be the opposite. This might cause me to dabble a little bit. And, you know, he said, well, John, you might be right, but they have data. And I looked into those data. He was right. They had data from Honolulu, and it was a big experiment. It had like 1,777 kids, but it was just a false positive. It was an error. And people don't really understand this, but when we do science, it's called the false positive rate. And in the best case scenario, that rate is still 5%. So 5% of the things we learn scientifically just by default are false positives. There's just no voltage there, even though the data are lying and telling us that there is voltage.
We're talking to John List, Sun Prairie High School graduate and UW Stevens Point graduate, now economics professor at the University of Chicago. His new book is called The Voltage Effect, How to Make Good Ideas Great and Great Ideas Scale. John, if somebody out there is thinking, hey, I've got this successful local business and I want to franchise it or go statewide or nationwide, or I've got a solution to a school problem that could be useful in other schools around the state, how would you recommend they start figuring out how to scale that up?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks, Rob. So the way I think about it is, before I started working in this area, it was an area of art. And what I mean by that, it was move fast and break things, or fake it till you make it. You know, these are famous Silicon Valley phrases, but it's really thinking about the science of scaling is an art. Now, what I'm adding here is real scientific insights. So the first half of the book basically says, if you have an idea, these are the five areas that you should test out your idea to make sure that it has the oomph that you believe it has. So for example, I talk about the slice of the pie that you're able to generate with your idea. I talk about, well, was your initial success due to an unscalable ingredient? Now here I talk about restaurants. Mm-hmm. A lot of restaurants try to scale, but if the initial success is due to the chef, then I'm here to tell you that it won't scale, because unique humans don't scale. And so there are just features like those two, and we also have spillovers and the supply side, that I basically give you a checklist that anyone, whether it's a person with an idea that might affect one person or a billion people, it's a scientific checklist that you should go through to figure out how scalable is my idea. And if it has features that you don't like, you then go back to the lab and change it around a little bit and put forward the idea that has a better chance to scale should you be interested in scaling.
We're talking to John List, economics professor at the University of Chicago. His new book is called The Voltage Effect, How to Make Good Ideas Great and Great Ideas Scale. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been at a workplace where a great new idea came along, maybe from elsewhere in your business or organization, school, whatever it might be, and then it fell flat when you tried to put it into practice? Have you tried to embiggen your own business or other idea at some point in your life? What worked? What didn't? What questions do you have for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with John List, economics professor at the University of Chicago. He was recently back speaking at his alma mater, UW-Stevens Point. We're picking up our conversation about his new book, The Voltage Effect, How to Make Good Ideas Great and Great Ideas Scale. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had an experience trying to take an idea, a business model, a training, you name it, and trying to make it bigger, bring it to more places? How did it work? What were the obstacles? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Nate is with us in Madison. Nate, hi.
Thank you very much. I happen to be a graduate of University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point also. Right. So good to hear you. So here's my issue. I'm an educator, and so I am very interested in upscaling a strategy that's been developed by people from across the state of Wisconsin, the rural areas. And the focus of the strategy is on about three key elements that we're trying to teach and implement with groups on a countywide type basis across the state of Wisconsin. And we've got a handbook, we've got a summary of the handbook, and we're planning to do a video orientation. What can you do? What can you offer me as suggestions how we might scale this up?
Interesting, Nate. Thanks. Nice concrete example there. John, what would you suggest for Nate?
No, I like it. First of all, Nate, congratulations on being a fellow pointer. It's always wonderful to hear from my brethren. It's obviously a great university, and I just visited there about 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I can tell you that things at Point are going great, and I'm really excited about the new leadership there. So yeah, that's a good question. I'm also working in education, and I started a pre-K school some years ago, and the elements that we found the hardest in terms of trying to scale in the area of education was, on the one hand, getting the attention of people who we wanted to send the message to. So in the book, this is chapter 2 about know your audience and understand how to get the attention of your audience. So I suspect that you have that as part of your problem, that you have something great to give, but they're not always in receipt or willing to receive it readily. And in that world, we've thought about different incentives to get people interested in our product, in our educational product, which we're giving away for free. But so you might say, well, wait a second, it's free. Why aren't they taking it up? Well, people are busy and there's an opportunity cost of time. So I think the first thing that you have to cross is understanding how to get the attention of your audience and to get their compliance and actually reading and listening to your materials. And the second one has to do with your delivery mechanism. So what we found is, in Chicago Heights, where I started a pre-K school, we needed good teachers, and the teachers needed to be a certain level of quality. The problem is, I only had to hire 30 teachers, but if we want to really scale it up, we knew we had to hire 30,000 teachers. And it's hard to hire 30,000 good teachers. It was easy to hire 30. So you might also have to think about the delivery mechanism and to make sure that the quality maintains as you scale. I like where you're going with the videos, because something that always scales well is technology. but technology doesn't always substitute well for humans. And in that case, you have to have the correct humans actually delivering it to make sure that people are learning what you want them to learn. So I think those are two of the biggest hurdles that you're going to have to overcome, Nate. But thanks for your question.
Nate, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Okay, let me test myself, John, and see if I've learned what you want me to learn. Would one possibility for Nate be to say, if they're hoping to get this in every county in Wisconsin, maybe pick one new county, maybe different than the one they're working in now, see if those ideas that worked in County A work in County B before trying to drop this thing everywhere?
Absolutely. You are a very quick learner.
Boom.
So, Rob, that's right. So the idea here is, instead of going full-blown right away with everything you have, why not try it out in a pilot? This is what we do. I used to be the chief economist at Lyft, and before that, Uber. We would choose one market and try out a few different things. And we would see if, you know, one way to attract people's attention might be a certain type of advertisement or a gift card or something, and then try out another way. And then once you figure out what works, then it's a lot easier to scale it across different counties in Wisconsin. And so, Rob, thank you very much. You're exactly right. That would be the approach, that the scientific approach that you would want to take to get the news out and attract attention.
We're talking to John List, economist, about his new book, The Voltage Effect, How to Make Good Ideas Great and Great Ideas Scale. One thing that struck me, John, especially in the later chapters of your book, is when you're going from something small to something big, that workplace culture that might have worked well, or you might have been able to get over the rough points in a small operation, can really start to fall apart when you go big. How do you translate workplace culture from small to big?
Yeah, Rob, that's a great question. So in chapter 9, I talk about scaling culture. So that's the title of that chapter. And you're exactly right. One kind of management style that will work when you go from one or two employees up to 50 or 100 might be altogether different than the management style and the approach you need when you go from 100 to 10,000 or 10,000 to 200,000. And that really is about, in the very beginning, how you recruit your workers, how you recruit your employees, how you generate an inclusive and diverse environment that has equal pay for equal performance, and how that then maps into an environment of collegiality, rather than, I've been in a lot of places where it's really misguided meritocracy. And meritocracy is great at its roots, but if it's misguided and it turns into a kleptocracy, then we're in trouble. And that's what I see a lot of organizations actually evolve into. But I think in the very beginning, you can lay the seeds for an inclusive and a collaborative environment, because in every study after study after study, what you find is the import of diversity. And what I mean about that is diversity of thought. So I want people on a team who come at a problem from very different perspectives. And in many cases, that diversity of thought leads to a lot more innovation, a lot more exploration, a lot more, we're just getting the job done at the most efficient possible way. And that ends up leading to a culture that can scale.
That makes me think, John, if I have an idea that I think is really good, I want to root for this idea, right? And I want everybody to agree with me, and that can get me into trouble. How can I overcome my, and I think most people's inbuilt defensiveness, and make sure I've got some, you know, good naysayers around me?
No, that's an excellent, excellent question. So look, we have an idea that's our baby, and we take offense when people tell us it's a dumb idea. And when they bring data to us, we say, that data, that's wrong. Here's the right data over here. It's called confirmation bias in psychology. When we have a baby or we have an idea that we're trying to expand and we really believe in, we look for evidence that supports our thoughts and our baby. And that's exactly what you do not want to surround yourself with. I totally get the person in the room who's constantly your critic. That can be too much at points, but you do need a rational person to say, look, let's kick the tires, and I'm going to be the devil's advocate for this idea, and I want to give some reasons why it won't scale. This is what I call a scaling unit within organizations. I want them to think scientifically, and I want them to be the critic to say, well, let's look at it from a different perspective. Or, you know, that may have worked for those people, but will it work for these other people who we're going to try to sell into as well? And I think you always need a devil's advocate in the room, because they will keep you honest. And it's not that you're trying to be nefarious. It's simply that as humans, we have built-in biases. And these biases are very, very difficult to overcome. So in many cases, you need an external force to try to allow you and make you overcome your own biases.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. And it's always, always wonderful to support public radio. Rob, you're doing a great thing, so keep it going, okay?
Thank you so much. That's John List, the Kenneth C. Griffin Distinguished Service Professor in Economics at the University of Chicago, a graduate, as we mentioned, of UW-Stevens Point. We talked to him today about his latest book. It's called The Voltage Effect, How to Make Good Ideas Great and Great Ideas Scale. Still time for you to share your thoughts. Have you helped make an idea, a business model, a training, whatever, scale up from local to big? What went right? What went wrong? You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up after the news, we'll check out the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson. Another day of Senate Judiciary Committee hearings going on today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk with the only person who has raced in every Birkebeiner ski competition since it started in 1973. Now, today is the third day of confirmation hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, the first black woman in history nominated, potentially the first to be confirmed, to the U.S. Supreme Court. Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee have brought up a wide variety of topics, including the historic nature of Judge Jackson's nomination, her take on the First Amendment, and hot-button conservative talking points, including critical race theory and gender. We're talking about the Supreme Court confirmation hearings of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching or listening to the hearings? What has stood out to you? What do you want from a Supreme Court nominee? What do you want to hear from senators in these confirmation hearings? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Susan Liebel is professor of political science at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here, Rob.
What has stood out to you over the 2 days so far?
Wow. The tone has just been like a ping pong match, in which it moves from sort of exceedingly hostile, interrupting, back to a kind of a, pitch the ball firmly over the plate and try to get the nominee to explain some of what might not have been explained or misunderstood during the more combative questioning. That stood out to me. And I guess, though, the manner in which she has been interrupted yet remained composed, I think that those two things for the moment are something that stood out to me.
Judge Jackson talked about her views on judicial transparency, her belief that regular people should be able to understand the courts, referencing her background as a public defender earlier in her career.
What I decided as a trial judge was that I was going to make sure that everyone who was in my courtroom, and especially the defendant, understood all of the procedures that we were going through, all of the steps. I spoke directly to them. I asked them, do you understand what's happening?
Can you talk a little bit about what Judge Jackson was saying there and her background as a public defender, which is fairly unique these days on a U.S. Supreme Court?
Oh, it's quite unique. The last one that we know of was Thurgood Marshall. So it's been quite a while. I think that she is trying very hard to take these questions that are sometimes very technical and case specific and translate them into an understanding of her wider approach to the law, which tends to focus on due process and how the adversarial system, how making an argument that you might not agree with is part of what makes the American system unique and, in her eyes, admirable. So I think that she's walking a fine line. On the one hand, she's trying to answer very specific questions. At the same time, she's trying to be understood by the American public.
There's a couple different ways of looking at a Supreme Court justice. I think in the public, commonly, and in the media, we often think liberal or conservative on our current American scale. But there are issues of judicial philosophy that different lawyers, different judges may hold. What are you seeing from Judge Jackson when it comes to those two scales of judgment?
Well, first of all, I think we found out that she really doesn't like the term judicial philosophy, and she prefers methodology. I think what we've learned about her in these hearings is actually she's a very moderate judge. Critical race theory has come up a lot, but she's actually the opposite of critical race theory. And from the left, there would be a lot to criticize in the approach that she takes. She's very comfortable with elements of originalism and history. Again, I think that may have been a bit of a surprise to people who were listening to the hearings. And also she rejected acceptance of looking at international law, which is something that Justice Kennedy from the right and Justice Breyer from the left did. I mean, she seemed to almost be supporting originalism yesterday.
And remind us what originalism is.
Originalism purports to create a neutral stance. So it says that the Constitution was written by two sets of framers, you know, at the time of the founding in the 18th century, and then the refounding of the nation after the Civil War. And that what we should do is look back to the original understanding of those framers and the public that they were speaking to. And that is often put forward as a neutral way of understanding the law, as opposed to a living constitution, which means that we interpret the words as we would today.
We are looking at the Supreme Court nomination hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Susan Liebel is with us, professor of political science at St. Joseph University in Philadelphia. You could join in with your thoughts on what you've seen and heard so far, your questions about the process, about the Supreme Court itself. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, if, as I mentioned earlier, if she's confirmed, Judge Jackson would be the first Black woman in history on the U.S. Supreme Court, she talked a little bit about the historic nature of her nomination.
I stand on the shoulders of so many who have come before me, including Judge Constance Baker Motley, who was the first African-American woman to be appointed to the federal bench and with whom I share a birthday. And like Judge Motley, I have dedicated my career to ensuring that the words engraved on the front of the Supreme Court building, equal justice under law, are a reality and not just an ideal.
Susan, how are senators from both parties treating the historic nature of the nomination?
Well, it's been radically different. She's receiving a lot of kudos from the Democratic members of the committee, a lot of space to explain her views, some specific questions about particular pet peeves of the Democratic senators. But she's been challenged very stridently by Senators Cruz, by Senator Hawley, by Senator Graham, and others in ways that are we've come to expect sometimes in these hearings, but really pushed to the edge of the kind of combativeness.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Preston, Minnesota. Randy, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was just listening to Josh Hawley's current round of questioning, and it seems to me his goal is to get the nominee to strike out and tell him what a jerk he is, to try and undermine, you know, and then that'll be the lead of all the papers and all the news. That, oh, she flipped out and she told Josh Hawley he was a jerk. I would have used more colorful language. But, yeah, he didn't really want to answer. He just keeps going as the same hot button. It's all about sentencing of people convicted of pornography. But I just read a book by a judge, Jeb Radoff, I think was his name, and it's Why the Innocent Plead Guilty and the Guilty and the Rich Go Free. And what they do to people is the prosecutors throw a million charges, and then they say, we'll cut you a deal. If you plead guilty to the one thing and you'll only get this, they make these deals. And so people say, well, if I don't plead guilty and I go to court, I go to a trial and I lose, I could go for 20 years.
I gotcha. Randy, to Randy's point about, for example, Senator Hawley's question, that idea of a kind of a trying to get theater, trying to get a moment in there. Even Republican Senator Ben Sasse referred to the I'll clean up his language, but basically a theatrical nature of some of the questioning. What do you think about what Randy had to say, Susan?
Yeah, he said mugging for the cameras. I think Randy is right about the baiting. So the hope is to disturb her composure. And as you see, she carefully keeps her hands folded. She doesn't move her body very much. She occasionally furrows her brow, but very little. And I guess I would go a little bit, and I agree with you as well, that this is, as Senator Sasse said, mugging for the cameras. But I think it's actually more. I think what we are also seeing is a kind of a racial dog whistle politics, in which what the senators are trying to suggest is that Black Americans are criminals, that Black lawyers are supportive of criminal behavior. So that somehow she is somebody who is not tough enough. But I don't think it's simply about toughness. I think that there's something else going on there in terms of a bias, a suggestion, for example, that neutrality, that she lacks neutrality. And I think there she's being asked to prove that she's not biased because of her gender and her race.
Randy, thanks for that call. We'll go to Fawn next in Madison. Fawn, hello.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to comment on Judge Brown Jackson's utter composure in the parts of the hearings that I have witnessed. She just maintained such equanimity, like such a sanguinity, just calm composure. It's such grace under pressure. That is just makes me admire her to the hilt. And I wish that she would make a model Supreme Court justice, in my opinion. In fact, I wish she were on our state Supreme Court for the same reason. But she, her behavior and her composure, her grace, her intelligence, and her measured responses were just nothing short of exemplary. I wish the same could be said for some of those senators.
Fawn, thanks for the call. Susan, you were just talking about some of that equanimity. Do you want to expand on what Fawn had to say?
No, I think Fawn is right. And there's been a lot of commentary, especially from professional Black women, talking about mansplaining and patronizing, and that this is something that you are watching her endure. Even the senators who are supporting her are often patronizing her. She's being told, like, you're a role model. She is, in a sense, the suggestion is she must prove that she is an exemplary American because of both her race and her gender. And I agree with Fawn that what we see is somebody who's being patronized, but is enduring being condescended to, interrupted, referred to as her and she. And that's really important because often it is the case that honorifics are denied Black professionals and women professionals. And we see that intersection here as she's called her and she instead of judge.
Fawn, thanks for the call. We're talking to Susan Liebel, professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph University, talking to us about Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's confirmation hearings ongoing this week. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. What has stood out to you if you've been watching, listening to, and or reading up on this process, on Judge the judge and her nomination for this seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. Your questions about Judge Jackson's credentials, background, where she might fit into the future of a Supreme Court if confirmed. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with St. Joseph's University political science professor and chair Susan Liebel about the Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Sarah joins us next in Libertyville, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Rob. You know, can I just comment super quick on what you were just talking about her composure? And because she is being so nice, and I realize that, like, she feels like she has to be that nice, but they're being so mean to her. And she's like, yes, yes, yes. She's, like, so nice. And I wish she could just, like, be a little more, like, not so nice. But and compare that to Brett Kavanaugh, who was just frothing at the mouth. He was so angry. But, okay, so my question is, do they really have a goal? Do you think they really have a goal, the Republicans, of thinking they could get enough votes to defeat her? Or are they just trying to discredit her for, like, the future court decisions that she'll make? Or are they just trying to look good for their voters?
Sarah, thanks for the call. Interesting question. Is the goal to derail the nomination? Is it to score political points, maybe in an election, midterm election year? What do you think, Susan?
It's a great question, Sarah, and there's been amazing work in political science done on anger and who's allowed to be angry. And she's not allowed to be angry. She has to remain that composed, or she will be criticized as either being shrill as a woman or being an angry Black woman. All of these stereotypes will be applied to her. I think her goal is to get herself confirmed. And the way the numbers work is that the Democrats have enough, if they can hold Manchin and Sinema in this vote for Vice President Harris, to then break the tie. They don't need any Republican votes. They're hoping to have some. And I think that they hoped that the three people who had voted for her the last time she was appointed federal judge, which was Lisa Mikulski and actually Senator Graham from South Carolina and Susan Collins from Maine, but it's not looking like the senator from South Carolina will be voting in her favor. He seems very, very hostile, but they don't need those votes. She hopes for them, but she doesn't need them.
Sarah, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us now in Elkhorn. Tim, hi.
Yes, the line of questioning now any different than the line of questioning that the previous Supreme Court candidates have had?
Tim, thanks for the call. His line broke up a little there. Tim saying, is this really that much different than past confirmation processes? These can be pretty heated.
So look, most of our history, it was simply advise and consent. There weren't long hearings. There was a voice vote. It was extremely rare for the Senate to reject the president's pick. It occasionally was about competence. President Nixon nominated two judges that did not get good ratings from the American Bar Association. And he famously said, there's a lot of mediocre people, so why don't we have some mediocre judges? And then had to nominate somebody else. Since the Bork hearings in 1987, in which Reagan was overturned, there has been some rancor, although after Bork, we really saw this settle down. And most of the justices had been unanimously, or close to unanimously, put on the bench, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg and people who we might think of as more controversial. So I think what we're seeing is right now is a relitigating of past rancor. Rancor from the Republicans over the Kavanaugh hearings, rancor from the Democrats in the Republicans not holding a hearing on Merrick Garland. And I think we're seeing a reflection of where our Senate's politics stand right now. There is not a lot of cooperation. And so the way I would place this, Tim, is to say it is extraordinary. And we very recently had this departure, and we should think about our entire Democratic history, I think, when we judge the kind of behavior that we're seeing in the last couple of days.
Talking to Tim and Elkhorn, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Susan Liebel, professor at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, political scientist there, looking at the ongoing confirmation hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. Susan, what is it about these Supreme Court confirmation that's gotten so divisive? Is it just, you were touching on this a little bit, the Senate in general getting more partisan? Is there something about a higher stakes at the U.S. Supreme Court? What's going on?
It's funny, there is no stakes actually in this confirmation. I mean, it's a 6-3 conservative majority. Even if Chief Justice Roberts occasionally votes with the liberals, that is still not enough to be a majority. So this is the most solidly conservative court that we've seen in modern history. So there isn't anything at stake. And I agree with what I think you said earlier, or one of the callers, that some of this is playing out the midterms, the 2020 vote for the presidency. I think we're seeing Republicans, for example, Cruz and Sasse, position themselves in different ways. What should a Republican look like? So I think it's extremely complicated. And look, it's happened before. A couple of the justices have mentioned Hugo Black, who was appointed in the late 30s by FDR. But there was a problem with his nomination. It was rumored that he was in the Ku Klux Klan. And because we didn't have the internet and all the documentation that we have, it wasn't confirmed until after he was confirmed that, in fact, he had been a member. Now, he went on to be a justice who did much for civil rights. But, you know, the kind of information wasn't available. And occasionally we did see very, very serious challenges to justices who were imagined to not be able to fulfill their duty on the bench.
What are you watching for as this goes forward now? The Judiciary Committee will finish up. What are you watching for in the rest of the process?
I'm watching to see just how far Cruz and others are willing to go on race baiting and repeating the child pornography material. I personally found it strange to hear them saying it over and over and over again, as they really seem to have established their point already. So they really seem to try to be rehearsing something. I don't think we're going to learn much more new about what anyone on the committee thinks. And I think it's just going to be watching the judge remain calm.
That child pornography angle, they have mentioned her sentences given to people who viewed child pornography. She points out within congressionally set guidelines, people have done stats, her charges or her sentences are within the norm, as I understand it. So why this particular line of attack just in our last minute or so?
I think this is just trying out what issues can possibly make people uncomfortable and stop any Republican who was thinking about crossing party lines and being unified behind the first Black woman and a highly qualified person. I think the last thing I'd say is I don't actually think she's unusual. She's has the same education and very, very similar corporate law background, et cetera, than almost everybody who is on the Supreme Court. And she's had very, very similar jobs as a judge. So in some ways, she was a very moderate, conservative candidate. And it's interesting to watch her being made into a radical, which she absolutely is not.
Susan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome. It was terrific.
Susan Liebel is professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. She talked to us today about the ongoing confirmation hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. Keep following the news at WPR.org. We'll have reporting there from our colleagues at NPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, we can face ethical dilemmas in our everyday lives, but how can we resolve those dilemmas? A Wisconsin ethics expert joins the show with advice, and you could join in with your questions, maybe your own experiences dealing with those conundrums in your own life. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you're feeling okay today, it's time to celebrate because it's the anniversary of the word or abbreviation, okay. As reported at history.com, this day in 1839 marks the first known use of okay in print in the Boston Morning Post. And what did okay stand for? All correct. Wait, wouldn't that be AC? Usually, yeah. But there was a cool slang thing at the time among the hipsters of the day where you intentionally misspelled words and phrases, so all correct was spelled all correct with an O and a K. Now okay has become one of the most commonly used words on the planet, even crossing language boundaries. And it all started with the cool kid meme of the day. What will stand the test of time in today's youth talk? Good soup. This is Central Time.